CliffCentral.com.
We never gonna die.
All right, that's famous.
That's what happens when you're famous.
Kanye West, famous. It's
all about. Think of the music video because you took that in as well.
Yeah, it's there's a lot going on here. Are these all wax figures or are they just be great actors?
Wax figures. They made like this is a couple of months back now, but you know Caitlyn Jenner's in there, Chris Brown is in there, Rihanna's on there. So the entire premise of the music video is just the camera pans over these naked bodies of the celebrities all in one bed. So the entire message of the song is like everyone aspires to be famous, but it's all these people who are mushed together with weird scandals and commonalities. So for example, Ray J is sleeping right next to Kim Kardashian.
Please tell me you're not reading a press release.
No, I'm not reading a press release.
Okay, and it's kind
of, I just know this. Anyway, you brought it up. We're doing it for
what's his name? This is interesting.
Exactly. So who else is on the bed? I forgot now. Yeah, but that's like the main things. Oh, Taylor Swift is naked on the bed as well.
So if these are all wax figurines, I mean, just the cost of this video must have been a pretty penny.
Well, let's not talk about costs for people who fly around the world in jets. So
I'm just saying. Yeah. I mean, I'm just imagining it.
Hey, it's just a day in the life of Kanye West.
But Ed Sheeran's not in this music video. So what Ed Sheeran must do is now make his own music video. It's called I'm Famous. And there's him and literally all these wax dolls of Taylor Swift and her harem.
Maybe not, hey? Maybe not.
See, this is a show where ideas come together. Don't you dare shout me down.
Okay. Well, talking about ideas, do you guys remember last week when we were talking about George Michael?
Yes. Yeah, fuddy for what?
Yes. And how we were sort of alluding and coming up with the ideas of like the greasy family members or the greasy uncles.
You're the one that used the word greasy, just
okay,
by the
fine.
Way.
I'll stand by it because I still think it's true.
And then we got some emails from Greek people that were really offended by that. Yeah.
Well, we got an email from one listener in particular, David, who came up with quite a good, like a theory, which I will stand up personally as well and say I side by. So, George Michael's real surname is Panuwatu. Now, which other famous Panuwatu do we know?
Ah, that PE murderer guy.
George.
Exactly. No, Christopher.
Oh, yes, my mistake. Thank you for that.
So could there not
be people called George?
Not all of them. George's cousin is George or someone. But could there not be a link there, party people? And Christopher is now like, you know, the murderous cousin and looking for money, more money to get out of his sticky situation. So he's now trying to wrangle some money from George's estate. David, I cross my arms here and I nod my head with you.
This sounds to me like Panuwatu slander. It sounds to me like all Panuwatus are being tainted with the same brush.
Am I inducing panic?
As we all know, not all Panuwatus are the same.
That's a very strong stretch of a statement to make. Do we all know? We don't know what the Panuwatus are up to. I'd love to. Yeah, I think we should do some family tree investigation on this.
Okay, let's get to these movies that have caused people to do weird things.
Yes.
It's quite hectic, actually, some of this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, I'm using the source of Unilad here because they have great articles like this. But, okay, well, remember the movie Scream, right?
Yes, guy in a mask loves chasing people and stabbing them with a knife.
Yeah, well, in 2001, Thierry Jardin, he was at that stage known as just a lorry driver.
Okay.
Thierry the lorry driver. He tried to make a sexual advance on his neighbor's daughter, who was 15. She brushed him off. He then went into another room because she wanted to exchange videotapes, neighborly things like that. He went into another room, got into full Scream regalia, and stabbed her 15 times.
What?
Dead. Yeah. Crazy, eh? Sorry. Stabbed her 30 times. She was 15 years old. And then he placed a rose in her hand and went next door to tell the dad what he'd done.
Jeepers.
But it was all... But oh, he's guys. In, like they said, it was premeditated, and it was very much inspired by Scream, the movie. Twilight?
Oh, no. Is someone biting on people's necks now?
Yeah. Some kid inspired by Twilight bit 11 of his classmates. 11.
Wait, I hope none of them died, right?
Was this a boy?
Yeah.
How old?
Young.
Okay. But like
foolish young.
Yeah, so none of them died or anything. He just had a biting little thing.
No. Died of house, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he was really getting right into the
No, look, you can obviously hit a vein or just get tetanus, but that kind of stuff can be treated quite quickly nowadays. Two co-workers encouraged young children under supervision to fight while they filmed the incident on a mobile device because Fight Club. So they watched Fight Club and they got these kids to just brawl like in car parks and they filmed them. And obviously these kind of things work. Taxi Driver. You remember watching that movie?
What was it about again?
Robert De Niro, deranged taxi driver, loses the plot, starts killing. Well,
oh no.
John Hinckley Jr. was so fascinated by the film that he aligned himself with the Robert De Niro character and developed an intense obsession with the young Jodie Foster. So Jodie Foster was in the movie, right?
Mm.
Hinckley Jr. went so far as to enroll in the same college as her, so he could bombard her with poems and slip notes under her door.
Mm.
This guy went on to attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan.
Jeez.
And then he even told Foster of his claims, wanting to do this.
Why, folks?
Yeah. He was institutionalized, basically, and now he lives with his mother. He's all old and messed up.
And the mother's still alive.
Yeah, humoring this kind of crap. Okay. In 2015, Emmanuel Kalajeye was branded the real Norman Bates. Norman Bates, psycho?
Yeah. Isn't the story there that he went into a trance where he would just murder and kill, and then when he snapped out of it, he couldn't remember the crimes that he'd committed?
He stabbed his mother 40 times, based on the whole psycho Alfred Hitchcock thriller. Crazy, huh? Mm. And he dressed up in her clothing, and authorities were eventually alerted by his mother's partner discovering the body after hearing a distressed voicemail made during the frantic attack, to which she could be heard screaming, "Don't stab me, don't stab me, you're a demon."
Oh no.
You're a demon.
A Clockwork Orange, The Purge, Natural Born Killers, all these movies have created copycat antics of people thinking they can live like this and do the things that they've seen in the movies. I mean, have you ever watched a movie where you wanted to do something? Like, I know that movie Heat was the basis for a lot of cash in transit armed heists that happened after like the sort of that 90s movie. Because people saw how you could basically derail a car, gun warfare, that kind of stuff. And people often say that movies are a bad influence on people. But if it's not a movie, these freakos will find someone somewhere else to try kill. Like the guy in the scream mask.
Yeah.
He would probably try rape more young girls and ultimately kill them because it wouldn't happen. Scream was just a real cherry on the top. That made him just go into his happy place where he could be this magical being. But then reality sets in and he's still a murderer.
I'm not surprised by this because I often think of, you know, these heist movies, you know, Ocean something or the other, where I just feel like they're giving criminals a plot or a way to steal as well. So, like, can we really blame the directors or the producers or the writers because they're just being creative? But for someone sitting at home, they go, actually, if I do rent a white van and, you know, 2 weeks later we have a murder on our hands or whatever the case is, it's crazy.
Yeah, again, it's always that next step, right? People will commit bad and do bad things. Is a movie really to be blamed? It's like kids and console games of like shooting things up, and they say, well, that's why the school shootings are an increase, because of first person games.
Yeah
it's quite a convenient kind of excuse. I still don't believe it's going to be one of those things you can't attribute to it completely, but it gives you ideas. It puts things in motion. If you hate someone back in, I don't know, medieval times, you might throw a rock at them. But if you were to watch a Mel Gibson Passion of the Christ, you might want to do more things to them. It's an interesting kind of debate, a topic point.
This is when the Kardashians chime in and say, well, at least if you watch us, no one dies.
I tell you
just
what,
your
I've,
brain cells.
I've never wanted to commit violent acts more than when I watch the Kardashians. Because it gets put on and my girlfriend knows, like, this isn't something that I enjoy. So I give her time, she can go watch it. But if I hear those voices, it goes through my entire being.
Because they all talk
so reluctantly,
Ben,
like they just don't want to talk.
Yeah.
So it's just going to come out like this. And every single fucking person talks like that.
Yes, yes, yes. I think that's the biggest problem.
I have no interest in owning a gun, but that stuff makes me angry. Okay, I've said too much.
Well, everyone talks like this except Busisiwe.
Yes, who is our guest with Gareth.
Yes.
Who's not here in person, but he's here in interview just for you.
CliffCentral.com.
A lot of that stuff is logistical. A lot of that stuff is budget-oriented. It's a lot of it is very, very hard scientific work. And then the fun part is seeing what you've written translated into actual visuals and hopefully really good characterization. But I mean, why am I talking about this when I know not the first thing about it? Busisiwe, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You've got a hell of a CV.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah,
I've been working a long time.
I was looking over it. I mean, first of all, happiness is a four-letter word, which was terrific.
Yeah, huge success.
Unbelievable. Yeah. You must have been thrilled because movies are hard.
Yeah, very, very hard. And, you know, we didn't expect this kind of success. Normally, local movies don't do that well because you're competing with overseas stuff and they have, you know, bigger marketing budgets, so they get out to people more. So, you know, inevitably, you just can't compete. So when it became so successful, it was just, yeah, it was mind-blowing. It was the second highest grossing film of 2016.
That's phenomenal. I mean, that's your child.
Yeah, yeah.
That's your kid. And if your kid ends up growing up to be a success, you're always much more thrilled than those poor parents who look at the kids and go, oh, God,
yeah, right.
This child is a disaster. All right, so where does this even begin for you? Because, you know, being a scriptwriter, lecturer, producer, all of that stuff looks great now, but it didn't just happen.
Yeah, true, true. I mean, where did it start originally? Like, how did I start writing?
Yeah, where did it come
from? Sure. I mean, I've been writing since I was a kid, really. And I think for me, I always say, I think writing, you either have it in your blood or you don't. Like with most art, you know, it's either in your DNA or it's not. And my parents, my father is a writer as well, an author, but more of nonfiction work. So it kind of ran in my blood. I grew up in an academic family, you know. So I started writing. I was born in South Africa, moved overseas to the States when I was still a baby.
But I heard you wrote your first professional play at 13.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the great part about growing up overseas was that there were a lot of opportunities. Like in the States, they really try to promote the arts, which I wish they would do more in South African schools.
We have a department, supposedly, that's meant to do that.
Yeah, well. So, I mean, I was exposed to that. I was exposed to a lot of art from an early age. You know, piano, you know, art, like sculpture and stuff like that. So I started writing even when I was 5. My parents still have the first short story I wrote when I was in kindergarten. Yeah. And then when I was 13, I was in New Jersey and there was a program for school kids to get into playwriting and competition statewide, and each state had it. And then they would choose the best writers, and we actually got to produce our plays and have professional Broadway actors come down.
Wow.
And then we got to direct professional Broadway actors. So it was quite an experience. Yeah.
Were your family, did you go to America in search of opportunity, or was it an exile situation? Or
yeah, I mean, it was sort of self-exile. My parents were both activists back in the day.
Mm.
And I'm from Eastern Cape, Mtata.
Right.
So that's where my father was quite active, that side.
First of all, how did Americans say Busisiwe Ntintili?
They didn't. Well, my name there was Busi, but they said Busi.
Busi.
Yeah, they can't say Busi, yeah. So for 20 years, I was Busi until I came back home.
But they obviously decided, look, this is not a place where we can raise our kids with all the opportunities they might be afforded in a place like America.
Mm. And also, I mean, he was quite active. He was quite vocal against the apartheid government then. And he had been arrested a few times. I remember when my mom was pregnant with me, he was in solitary confinement at the time. And after he got out, she was like, no, we got to get out of here. here because, you know, you might end up dead. So we ended up moving when I was three. Luckily, through scholarships, my parents got to go overseas and study, which is how a lot of South Africans got out.
Yeah.
Through education.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, what a benefit to you that you got to then be exposed to this artistic world and you got to benefit from that.
Yeah.
As opposed to kind of having to fight for your life in Mthatha in those difficult days.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know how South Africans are. They will find a reason to elevate their own situation over and above yours, and they'll say, oh, well, you were one of the lucky ones,
mm-hmm.
and that this self-imposed exile makes you privileged.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll come back home, and members of your own family will give you shit about it.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't experience it so much in my family, but I experienced it more just with general Black South Africans. You do get that. I'm over it now.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I think people think whatever situation you grew up in, people always think that they had it worse, you know. And I think everything is relative. I know we struggled. My parents worked hard and. I remember, like, growing up, we thought, me and my sisters thought we had the best childhood. And then we only found out when we were adults that we were, like, you know, on government stamps. And you know what I mean? We didn't know we were on welfare.
I was talking to my mom and one of her friends yesterday at a family lunch. And I said to them, you know, even though we went through stages when we were growing up where we didn't have any money and where we did, I never felt poor. When you're a kid, you don't think about that.
No,
stuff.
You don't. Yeah. As long as you have love, that's all
sure,
you want.
That's
yeah.
all you care about when you're a little kid. But, I would imagine it must have also been tough because you're in America, but you're a South African girl and you're growing up and during those very impressionable years, and being a creative person yourself. You must have struggled with identity at least a little bit. I'm not saying that this is a defining thing, but here you are in New Jersey and you're speaking English and French rather than, you know, Xhosa. And it must have been kind of a little bit odd.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah.
Maybe empowering, maybe a strengthening experience, but sometimes a bit odd.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I was lucky because I was three when I went over. So pretty much my entire upbringing. But I know my older sister, who was nine, struggled a lot because she had this weird South African accent, you know, and the kids didn't understand it. And American kids are, you know, the one thing I found interesting coming back here was how polite South African children are. I was like, geez, like they're really like, you know, nice. Whereas American kids are not so much. So yeah, I mean, that kind of thing. But I mean, when you're young, you learn how to assimilate very quickly. But I think the one thing that maybe has always affected my writing was I always felt like an outsider, you know, and I think it's because of my parents as well. They always instilled in us, yes, we're here in America, but don't you ever forget that you're African, you know, and they instilled that sense of pride in our Africanness. And also, I think they were trying to prepare us for the real world that listen, you know, I remember my dad would always, you know, tell us, you're Black, you're a girl. The world is not going to be, you know, trying to open up doors for you. So you're going to have to, like, work your butt off, you know, to get what you want in life. So having that, like, drilled in my head, like, I always had this feeling that, yes, I'm here, but I'm not really like the rest of them. And then coming back home, I felt the same way.
Yeah.
But I think it helped to be an outsider because, like, I observed a lot. I observed people a lot.
And you maybe didn't take things as personally because you thought, oh, well, I can always just change my environment and fit in more or less depending on how I want to camouflage myself.
True.
I mean, kids learn that too, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious, though, because you always wanted to come back and you wanted to make the largest part of your ability to make a difference here. You understood that even from a young age, which is quite something.
Yeah, again, I think it probably goes to my parents. Like, I think if I didn't grow up in a household where, and look, my parents we were one of the first South Africans to go over. We went over in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, a lot of other activists started coming over. So we were kind of like the Ellis Island of South African activists.
So you had to see all these people in and out of your house.
We always had people staying in our house. And so I got to understand, you know, different people, first of all, and also understand what it's like to struggle and to
any
believe
of these
in
people
something.
Who we would know?
Some of them. I mean, some people I called uncle are like in government today. So
yeah.
yeah. or working, you know, CEOs of big banks and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
It must have been pretty amazing. You know, for you at the time, you didn't understand the historical significance of it yet. But it must have been cool to have been that Ellis Island of immigrants.
Yeah, no, it was.
Self-imposed exile.
Yeah. And look, my parents continued, you know, while they're overseas, you know, my dad would tour all over the world giving talks about what was going on in South Africa. So he kept his activism alive. So I think for me that, it showed me that you don't give up the fight even, you know, when you get out, you do
when you're
you
not
can.
On the battlefield, yeah. The fight carries
There's
on.
There's different ways of fighting.
So, all right, let's get to you because although that is fascinating stuff, the most interesting thing to me is just how much creative output you've had in the last couple of years. I mean, you're not, you look really young. How old are you actually?
Yeah, people think I'm young. I'm actually 40.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So, well, look, 40 years. Yeah. Let's just look at some of the things you've done here. You've been in the advertising business. You've been in museum curation. You've been in broadcasting. You've lectured. You've produced your own film and television documentaries, soapies.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like your CV is the CV of a 70-year-old.
Yeah.
By the looks of things. Is that because you have actively sought out a lot of stuff to do? You get bored maybe very easily. You like to keep yourself very busy. Or is it just that you're unavoidable in this country when it comes to the unique talents you have?
I think it's both. I think I'm talented. And I also think, you know, talent eventually does rise, you know, and people do notice you when you're talented. But also I think, I'm very ambitious and I always have been. And yeah, I do, like, I like a challenge. And once I've done something and conquered it, like, you know, I want to move on to something else. But I think also part of it also has to do with, I knew from probably around the age of, you know, 13, 14 that I wanted to be in movies. But it's not a direct, you know, the arts field, entertainment field is very difficult to crack. You know. So you kind of...
You have to do everything.
You got to do everything, you know, and you have to prove yourself. So I started out in advertising and hated it because I just felt like I was lying. But it was a good training ground. But I always knew my prize was always I want to get into television and film. So I kind of went roundabout, you know, got into TV through Big Brother, of all things.
Really?
The very first Big Brother.
What did you do there? What was your...
I was a logger.
Oh,
you know, those people
no.
who sat in the control room and basically logged everything that happened in the house.
Oh, no.
When people went to the toilet and, yeah.
What a horrible job.
It was fun, though. I mean, I was a kid. I was like in my early 20s, you know.
You have to take note of when someone's gone to the shower.
Basically.
Okay, but then fun. The real love of your life is probably writing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not the most glamorous of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, authors can sometimes become superstars and celebrities, but it's a rarer thing than singers and actors and those kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
Who are much more, and even painters.
Mm.
When you write, it's a very solitary pursuit for most writers. And even if you're writing a script in a team, you have to go and do your bits on your own.
Yeah.
What's the exhilaration? What's the thrill? I can see when it's an actor and they get on the stage or they film a great scene.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, when do you see the thrill? Is it when someone else performs that part of the script that you've done?
Not really even. I think the thrill comes in the actual is in the doing of it, is in the writing of it. I think for writers, I'll speak for myself. You know, I'm not I don't like this limelight and, you know, but I think the idea of creating something out of nothing, you know, creating a world, creating characters out of nothing, to me is like, in a way, it's like playing God, you know. You're playing God in your own little universe. But then you also get to say stuff. You get to say things that matter, hopefully, about life. And I've always seen writing as like, we all live life and we're all trying to make sense of our lives every day, you know, but some of us don't have the tools to make sense of it. So for me as a writer, it's like, you're shining a light on life for other people to be able to be like, oh yes, that's, you know, I recognize that. That's what life is about. And for me, that's like, that's a high for me. So that moment, like whenever you're writing a story, you always have that moment before you crack the meaning of the story, you crack the, you know, where you're searching for it, you know, it's like a puzzle. And then when you get it, it's amazing.
Isn't it true also that the truth is the thing that works the best for you?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're a writer, if you can translate someone's feelings in the truest way possible, if you can translate a situation, a story, a thought into the most perfect words to describe that situation, it almost kicks an involuntary reaction in people who are observing.
Yeah,
and it's the same way as humor is involuntary. You don't choose to laugh. You don't go, I'm going to decide to laugh about that. Mm. It either comes or it doesn't.
Yeah. Humor is like the perfect example because, I mean, humor is able to cut through sort of all the BS and get to the truth of something.
Yeah.
And when it hits it, that's when, you know, you've got an audience.
Okay, but now when you're script writing, let's say you take, because a lot of these people who are script writing for major movies, for example, will do it because there's a great book that everybody's talking about and they grab it. They buy the rights to the book. But a book isn't a screenplay or a script.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think the difference between novels and film is that novels have to describe everything, you know, because you're not, see, there's no visual. So, you know, you have to describe, a novel has to contain all the five senses. Whereas script writing, actually, less words is better. Less is more because you're using an audiovisual medium. And so it's about, and it's difficult. People who first start script writing find it difficult because you have to learn the art of less and of showing more. They always say show, don't tell in TV and film. So you have to learn how do you tell the story through, an action, through nonverbal communication as well. So that's usually the hardest part about translating a novel into a film.
And when you do things like soap operas, that's very different because in a soap opera, a lot of people think this stuff is facile, but it's really complicated because even in a soap opera, you have to hit the right notes to keep the audience engaged because though the plot may at times seem to be completely ridiculous, for the people who watch that every day, these are important events. These are important things these characters say.
Mm.
They remember them. They know the backstory.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't hire someone off the street and say, all right, write the next three episodes. Because unless they know what's been going on for a long time before then, they're going to mess it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And I imagine also for soaps, your whole tone and style is different.
Yeah, it's completely different in soapies. Soapies is a little bit like theater. In that it's bigger and everything is more exaggerated. And they always say, you know, I remember when I first started writing soapy, I used to write poetry and things like that. And so it was more esoteric writing. And they were like, you need to be more obvious, you know, when you're writing a soap. Because also people are at home and they're doing other things, you know, they're cooking dinner, they're whatever. So in order to grab their attention, you kind of have to be more on the nose with soapy. Whereas drama and film, it can be more subtle.
Did you ever find yourself writing ridiculous things for soap operas?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Those ridiculous lines you hear them say, oh, but I love you and you're the only one for me. Do you sometimes feel because partly it's a job. You've got to do a job and you've got to do that job for the audience that watches that, which means you have to honor the verbal reality. That can be frustrating, though, for someone who, you said it yourself just a moment ago, what's the real meaning here? In a soap, there doesn't have to be real meaning. So you couldn't just work on soaps. You'd go crazy, right?
Yeah. No, I would. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's why I've also done such a variety of work. You know, the thing I love about soaps is the discipline of it. Like, I think every writer who wants to sort of is serious about being a working writer should try to do soap at some point because it's just relentless. It's like a machine. And you learn the discipline of writing and meeting deadlines and things like that and structure. But, you know, sometimes the more artistic side of it, the more creative side of it gets lost. But, yeah, I mean, it's a job just like any other job. And, you know, you're speaking to broadcasters, to audience, to sponsors. So you have to be aware of the business side of it as well.
What is, for you, I mean, the soap opera audience, what do you think they are? I mean, why do you think it's so popular in South Africa? Because in television, soaps are unassailable. Mm. They're at the top of the charts.
Yeah.
Position 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's they're popular all over the world. I mean, they're kind of dying down overseas. But I think they've always been popular. I think people just, you know, I think people want an escape from their daily lives, you know. And, you know, people's lives are hard, especially yeah, in South That's Africa. True. And so you just, you know, like, yeah, dramas are fantastic and people, you know, want to also think about the deeper things of life. But also sometimes they just want to switch off and, you know, and put themselves vicariously through something else.
Now, there are things that are more frustrating than soaps to write for. And you've been complimentary about them. I'm not going to twist your words. But filming for corporates and, I mean, some of that is just soul-destroying stuff.
Yeah.
Because you've got some horrible corporate message going in here, and we're not going to mention any names. Mm. You've worked on lots, and they've all been terrific, I'm sure. Mm. And you put your heart and soul into them just like you would anything else. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it feels a bit like corporate propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And propaganda of any kind is not as much fun to make as open-minded stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that's why I hated advertising. Just because I felt like, you know, first of all, we were selling, you know, stuff to people that we knew they don't need it and the product doesn't work, you know, and it's probably going to make them sick, you know, but you know what I'm saying? But you're trying to convince people that you definitely need this in your life and it's going to change your life. And so I just felt like it was a really, you know, disingenuous industry to be in. And also sort of it's motivated by pure greed, you know, at the end of the day. It's not really motivated by any kind of generosity in terms of wanting to change people's lives. So yeah, for me, that just wasn't for me.
But on the other side of the scale, you have got to do really meaningful stuff. I mean, you did a lot of the short films for Freedom Park, for example.
Yeah.
And that must have been interesting because then you get to do a little bit of history. You get to do a little bit of the story of this country, the
yeah,
people who have sacrificed so much for this country in so mm-hmm, many ways. It must have rung for you a lot of internal bells about maybe, you know, your own parents and their activism,
Mm-mm-mm,
the fact that there were all these people in this country who put up with so much for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, that's one of the works that I'm most proud of. And I, you know, we have our problems with our current government and how our democracy has panned out. But, it was an honor to work on that project because, it's something about legacy, you know, and it's something that's going to be there forever. It was the first exhibition of the Freedom Park Museum. Mm-hmm. So that was an honor in and of itself. And then we shot it in like 2 months, traveled all over the country, met all kinds of people who, stories that I didn't even know, like history that I didn't know existed about, you know, stuff that people went through. And it was heartbreaking and inspiring and all of that stuff, you know. But even the sad part of it was that some of that stuff still exists today. You know, we went up to Marikana and interviewed a miner who's like 80 years old, who'd been working in the mines his entire life, and today lives in a shack that has water falling through, you know? So those kinds of stories, you think, wow, this guy's been, you know, toiling his whole life, and still he's got crap to show for it, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was something.
Are you one of those people, because when you do this kind of documentary, you try to give history as much truth as possible, mm-hmm, but everything is subjective. So mm-hmm, you're one of those people who goes, well, you know, history is told by the victors usually. History is usually written in a broad stroke where it leaves out a lot of the detail. Or are you one of those people who believes that we must try as much as possible to accurately record everything that's going on? I mean, it sometimes happens here with me. I'll interview someone who was a part of the struggle, but who's largely unknown until they tell their story and people are very moved by it and all of that stuff. But it isn't Nelson Mandela or Oliver Tambo or Walter Sisulu or Albert Luthuli or any of those people.
Mm. So I agree.
History's subjective.
Absolutely. I mean, it depends on who's writing it.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes.
Isn't
back
that
to
frustrating
stories
when you're trying to tell the story? Because you want to, you want to tell the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it definitely is. I mean, even I've done documentaries where, you know, for government or whatever, where you're sort of told you need to take this out. because it's going to make the government look bad. Because it's a story from the past that's going to make... And that's very frustrating when you're like, but this is people's experience. This is what they've experienced.
And, you know? And if they're paying the bills, I suppose they get to say.
Yeah, yeah.
God, that must be horrible.
Yeah, it's tough. But I think that's why it's so important that we tell stories, you know. Mm. And that's the power of storytelling. I think if we don't tell stories, all of that history is going to be lost. So the more, you know, people like yourself or myself or other storytellers in whatever medium we're working in, get people, real people's stories out there, I think we're helping to fill in the gaps, you know.
What about the 1956 Women's March that you also did a documentary, a short sort of film on. Mm. Tell me about that, because you got to interview the few surviving women who are still around from then, in terms of the women who arranged it and led it.
Yeah.
But it must have been quite a moving thing, too, as a black woman who wasn't around in 1956, but who knows how much of what we have today was paved by them.
Mm.
And the kind of bravery it took. I mean, women in 1956 were told what to do and didn't dare raise their voices in opposition.
Mm-mm.
It was very, very brave for those days.
Yeah, I mean, we look at it from today and think, because now we've got freedoms.
We see all these women marching against Trump and we think, well, that's quite something. Yeah. These women did it in a time where that was a real threat to your personal safety.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you didn't even speak up to your husband, let alone speak up to, like, the entire government. So, yeah, it was super courageous. And meeting the women and hearing the stories. And also what struck me, so that documentary, we reenacted the trip that the Eastern Cape women took from Port Elizabeth to Pretoria. You know, because women were coming from all over the country to meet up there. So we took that same train ride, and that's where we filmed the bulk of the documentary. But it was amazing to hear about how they stood up when their husbands were basically, a lot of them were not around because they were on the mines or they were working in Joburg. So they became like the husband, the wife, that they became, you know, they had to step up. They had no choice in a way. But I found it fascinating how they were able to coordinate. This was thousands and thousands of women across the country in a time when we had no internet, no cell phones, but just through word of mouth. And it's like, geez, we can't even do that today with Facebook.
No. And I mean, these days, you know, you get 1,000 likes on Facebook and you think you're an activist.
Yeah. 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 That's true.
And these women were real.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stalwarts. Yeah. When you write, you can't help obviously bringing in your own experiences and your own thoughts about things. Do you sometimes have to check yourself and go, whoa, 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 this is now becoming about me. It shouldn't be about me, because it would be a natural thing to do.
Mm.
It's much easier to autobiographize things than to tell someone else's story, because then you make it personal. And it's almost like our default setting as humans is to me, everything.
Yeah.
How do you stop yourself from doing that? Or do you find a way to make it useful?
I think it's both. Like, I think one of the things that really irritates me about young writers, or there are funny enough writers who want to write because they want to be famous, if you can believe that, because they do believe it's a glamorous or whatever.
Don't talk about J.K. Rowling like that.
I'm not talking about her. But like, I think, and so sometimes they write because they're trying to be cool or trendy or whatever, but they actually have nothing to say. And I think if you have nothing to say, I mean, you've seen movies where you think, why on earth was this made? This is like utter rubbish, you know? But I think the first thing, if you're going to write, is you should have something to say about something, you know, whether it's deep or not, but just a point of view. But then when you have that point of view, I always think the best writers are the ones who are able to get outside of themselves and put themselves in another person's shoes. It's easy for me to see life through the eyes of a black South African woman, but it's harder to see my, you know, life through the eyes of a white Africana man. And to be a great writer, you need to be able to do that. You need to see what motivates that person. What are that, you know, what's that person's fears and all that kind of stuff. So in a way, I think, you know, the greatest writers are people who have a huge amount of compassion for other people. Because you can't put yourself in someone else's shoes if you don't. You know, if you're judging them, it's impossible to see, you know, to see the world through your eyes if I'm sitting here judging you as a white man. You know what I'm saying?
Isn't that respect?
Yeah, yeah.
In some way. I mean, you know, someone gave me that definition once before. They said if you break it down into its Latin, then it's re, which is again, and spec is to look.
Yeah.
So it's to see it through someone else's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that as a writer, you could probably put yourself in situations in real life where you are able to immediately consider respecting the other human being. I mean, that's maybe why during the struggle in this country, there were so many great writers on both sides who got together and spoke long before the politicians could or the economists could.
True.
Or the workers could.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, that's why you had a lot of those, dissonant writers in, you know, the 60s, 70s, black and white, you know. I mean, I did my thesis in varsity on the work of André Brink, who was sort of discovered overseas, and I just fell in love with his work.
Maybe we did do one of his books at school, André P. Brink. I remember the
name. Yeah. Great writer. He wrote a lot of books. I mean, he wrote, what's that name?
It's just ringing bells for me. I don't know.
Yeah, my brain is gone.
Don't worry. I'm not going to. This is not a test. Are you a bit of a movie snob?
No, not really. No.
Can you watch Transformers and not throw up into your popcorn?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I love to be entertained as well. You know what I mean? Okay. So yeah, no, I'm not.
You would think, you said it earlier, it's got to mean something. It mustn't be out of rubbish. Otherwise you feel like you've wasted your time.
Yeah.
Sometimes those people tend to be a little bit more picky and choosy.
Yeah.
About what they watch.
Yeah, I used to be. I think when I was younger, I used to be a little bit more of an artistic snob. But yeah, I think with age, I'm like, who cares?
Now you'll watch superhero movies.
And also I've found I find a lot of sort of Cinema Nouveau movies to be really pretentious.
Yes.
Like, I'm like, oh gosh, like, can you just tell the story? Like, you don't have to be so clever, you know? And sometimes a lot of those indie filmmakers and writers try to be too clever that they lose the plot. And
at the end of the day, it's like self-absorbed, right?
Yeah, self-absorbed, and then you're speaking to yourself, and you forget that there's an audience, you know? And I think the number one rule, no matter what you're writing is, you need to entertain the audience, you know? So yeah, I love your mass market type films as well. As long as there's a solid story.
Do you think there's a good degree of skill that's put to play in movies like that? Because again, scripting is probably everything in a movie like that. Even though you're saying less, as you already indicated, you have to say exactly the right words because that audience is so fickle.
Yeah.
They will disengage immediately if you don't get it right.
Mm. Which audience are you speaking of?
I'm talking about the mass market audience for those big, you know, kind of action movies. Plus, your stars are really stupid, so they can only say a few words in a row.
Yeah,
they're not going to learn Hamlet's monologue.
No. Yeah. I mean, I've seen some really great stories in sort of like big action, you know. I mean, like Die Hard is one of the best sort of story, you know, the first one. So when you combine like action and, you know, CGI and all the stuff with a great story, then I think you struck gold. It's just unfortunate the majority of them are not like that.
When you write a character that you've come up with on your own, or you develop a character that you've had a hand in creating, is it almost like it's like raising a child. I mentioned a child earlier. You kind of at some point have to let them go, because the actor's going to add a spin to things. The producers and directors are going to add some spin to things. It might end up that the character you had envisaged at the start isn't the character that ends up being on screen.
Yeah.
And you have to just be okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to let it go.
Can you? Is that easy? Did you have to learn to do that?
Yeah, I had to learn. Because, I mean, at first you do take it super personal. Like, you know, because you slave away for hours, months, sometimes years on a story. So you definitely have a clear vision of what that character is like. And then maybe a director or an actor just stuffs it up. And, it hurts at first, you know. So I used to take it personally. And then, you know, with experience, you learn that you just have to let it go. Once it leaves your hands, it's no longer yours, which is also the beauty, I guess, of this art form, is that it's collaborative, you know. But I think I kind of have the OCD side of me still can't let it go, which is probably why I became a director as well.
And now, what are the major thrills of directing as opposed to writing?
I think directing, you know, I'm an introvert by nature, but I love people, and directing brings out a different side of me. You know, like you said, like writing, it's you by yourself, and you really don't have feedback from other people. You're a script editor, yes, but that's it. But I love the collaborative nature of directing, and being able also, like someone who just, you know, I love design. I love fashion. I love, so you get to like be involved. I love music, you know, so to be involved in all those areas is amazing.
Do you ever find that you have to choose between these roles and that it's difficult for you, or is there always going to be the favorite one? Because as you rightly said, the entertainment business is tough. You can't just do one thing, but when you say, and it's not you boasting, but when you say you're a writer, producer, filmmaker, director, all those things, it almost sounds like a laundry list sometimes. And if you had to have one word on your tombstone one day, what would it be?
I think it'd probably be storyteller.
Yeah.
Because it encompasses it all, you know.
But it's such a, it doesn't sound exciting. I know what you're saying. But storyteller sounds almost like the old granny in the village who keeps the oral traditions going.
Yeah, but I mean that's what we do. It's just in a modern age.
I know, but on a good day when you're feeling self aware and actualized, I suppose you can take it as a great compliment to be called a storyteller.
Yeah,
but on another day you might think, oh well, I'm just some.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I mean, people know me as a writer. That's how. That's how people know me, and I think that's where. The core of my reputation lies in writing. So I'll always be a writer, no matter what I do. But yeah, why I say storyteller is because I think, you know, writing is just telling stories at the end of the day, and you could do it in a lot of different ways. So I don't like to be sort of boxed in into, yeah.
What do you still want to do? I mean, I mentioned your CV at the beginning of this. You've done so much stuff already. What would you still like to do that you feel you haven't done yet?
A lot, eh? radio, for one. I'd love to do radio. I mean, I started
what kind of radio?
Well, I'd love to do like working with my partner on a podcast. Because I do.
Come and talk to us about that.
Yeah, I should actually.
Yeah, we'll help you put it together.
Okay, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So yeah, just
what kind of podcast, by the way?
Look, I write a lot of stuff on Facebook where I just rant, and it started out as that, me just ranting about are you allowed to swear on the show?
Yeah, you can say whatever you
like. Yeah, bullshit, you know, that's happening in the country. And so and then people started responding to
it. Political stuff?
Political, social, across the board, you know.
And what irritates you so much that you're ranting about this on Facebook?
Everything.
Because Facebook, you're asking for trouble a lot of the time, you know?
You
get very unwelcome responses occasionally to this stuff. So give me an example of what irritated you in the last few weeks.
In the last few weeks? Jesus. The SAFTA nominations came out recently.
You've got some SAFTAs in the bag, right?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Okay, so what irritated you about that?
Look, I mean, the majority of the nominees were white, and it's been something that people in the industry have been protesting against and for years. But it's getting worse. Actually, it's not getting better.
Is that because the television industry is still largely dominated by white people in important positions?
Yes.
Or is it because they're actually doing better work?
It's because the industry, it's really indicative of the industry. It's because, you know, the majority of people who work in the industry are black, but the people who are in those positions, in the HOD positions, are white. So when they get, when people are nominated, it'll be a white person.
So whose fault is this? Because this is irritating to all of us.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's problematic, and it's not like an easy fix. And you can't blame white people for hiring white people, but also I think it's a mindset that we still haven't gotten out of. And I see it even with black, you know, broadcasters is there's still a mindset that thinks that white is automatically better. You know? Mm-hmm. And so it's going to take a while to break out of that. Usually the only places where I see black people in positions of power is usually where there's a black producer involved, you know?
So producer's the key role here.
Yeah. So producers it's key. And also broadcasters also need to take a stand as well about it. But yeah, I mean, it's disappointing for sure. I mean, you see that stuff happening overseas where they're talking about Oscars so white and
I remember that. And then, they overcompensate the next year and everybody goes, oh my God, this is so cosmetic.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I feel like they have a voice there and, you know, black people are a minority in America. But here, black people are a majority and still, like, it's really depressing that we are dealing with this in 2017. So stuff like that. And like education, that really grinds my nuts. Just the state of education in this country. So yeah, that kind of stuff.
Good. Yeah. We need people ranting and raving.
Yeah.
Otherwise, how are we going to know whether we're right or wrong?
Yeah.
And if the worst thing you want is apathy, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's for or against a political position or for or against a social position, you want people to have opinions.
Yeah, yeah. No, we should just be thinking. We should just be aware of what's happening. I mean, if you're a citizen of a country, you should be aware of what's going on in your own country, you know.
What do you think of what's going on in America at the moment? I mean, you were an American for a long time.
Yeah. Where do you start? Like, I don't know.
Top of your head, what do you make of all of this?
I think it's funny. I think it's ridiculous. Like, it's just, I don't know. Sometimes I wake up and I think we're all in the Twilight Zone. Like, it just doesn't, like, feel real even, you know? Like, it feels like it's one big prank and someone's going to say, we're just kidding, you know? But the scary part is that it's real. But what's even scarier is that it's not just in America. It's happening in Europe, too. I mean, this whole sort of, I feel like the past few years, there was sort of like a consciousness shift in the world where people were really starting to stand up, ordinary people, for the voices. You know, and you saw it with that 99%. You know, it started with that, you know, marching against Wall Street. And then with Fees Must Fall, I mean, students in America were supporting the South African Fees Must Fall movement, Black Lives Matter. Like, but I saw that, like, there was sort of like a consciousness that was going, a global consciousness of the underdog finally standing up. But obviously, when there's always a movement like that, there's going to be backlash. So I feel like this is sort of the backlash. And I also think it's orchestrated. I don't think it's by chance. I think it's very deliberate. And it's frightening. I think people need to wake up, realize that, you know, your voice is, if you don't speak up for what you believe in, liberties can really be taken away like that. We've seen it happen.
Obviously, you must then be one of those people who's very much for freedom of speech.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Because a lot of the time, it has always traditionally been the role of the right wing to try to stifle freedom of speech, book burning and banning and that kind of thing. The apartheid government did it here. Mm. It seems to me that in America, there's a lot of the left doing that at the moment with political correctness, where you can't say certain things, where certain people are prevented from speaking because they're privileged, you know, or they represent a certain point of view that's unwelcome and people's safe spaces are being hurt and that kind of thing, which is ridiculous in the same way as the right is ridiculous. Yeah. It's maybe not as militant and dictatorial and totalitarian in its practice, but in its theory, it's just as damaging.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it also, like, it polarizes, and that's what people in power want. I mean, they don't want a black person and a white person to sit down and talk and realize, actually, we might have more in common than we do differences. They want people to stay polarized. They want people to be like, I'm right, you're wrong, because it's easier to control people when they,
and
you know,
they love to distract us with bullshit.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know. How many TV shows do you watch that are, you think, well, this is not telling the real story because we need to be distracted by the lions in the circus.
Yeah,
and the bread
sure.
that you throw around. What do you think of TV at the moment? Because that's resurgent in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are TV series that have got bigger budgets than some feature films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And some of them are better than feature films.
Yeah. I mean, TV in America for sure. Like, overseas, that's where it's at. Like, TV is the medium right now.
What do you watch, like, when you come to series and things?
Look, I mean, I usually watch a lot of overseas stuff. Recently, I like drama. You know, I was watching The Affair. Really great story about something that we've seen told so many times, but told in an interesting way. Ray Donovan. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. Yeah, I'm trying to think.
I love the way that these TV shows now get, you know, the greatest writers and directors and actors in them. And TV's finally got some respect back from the movies.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
The movies always used to be the top of the pile, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now bigger stars want to be in TV shows. Yeah.
And it's a regular paycheck.
Mm, absolutely, yeah.
Is there enough money in this business in this country?
There is if you get to a certain, like if you, once you get to a certain point. There's like a tipping point, let me put it that way. Like you, for, when you're a certain level, you're not going to get paid very well. And then when you tip over to, you know what I'm saying, to another level, then you get paid ridiculous. There's ridiculous amounts of money.
So I'm guessing then that you have passed that tipping point. You may up and down a little bit, but
yeah.
You know where it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've passed the tipping point, yeah.
Well, that's good. Then you've got success.
I mean, look, like pinch, yeah. Like, you know, when you think about like what we do, like I think, geez, you know, like it's make-believe and we get to have fun and create stuff and we get paid a crap load of money for it, so you really shouldn't complain a lot of the times. Yeah.
Well, I'm thrilled to meet you, and congratulations on all your success so far.
Thank you.
amazing stuff, and I hope that we'll continue to benefit from you
writing and
producing and directing and all of these things, and hopefully we'll hear you doing podcasts soon too.
Yeah.
What a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you too.
Busisiwe Ntintili, who is South Africa's, I would say you're right up there. You've got to be one of our proudest creatives in the business at the moment, and with good cause, with good success stories to her name, awards, even if she doesn't agree with the awards, the means of those awards being distributed every time, you earned them fair and square.
Thank you. Yeah.
In fact, if the system is to be believed to have been, you know, skewed in a different direction, it's even more of an achievement.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Congrats.
Thanks.
What a pleasure to meet you. Thank you, Busi.
Cheers. CliffCentral.com.
Now, just the other day, I actually discovered that happiness is a four-letter word, which is one of the movies that Busisiwe has written, mm-hmm. Currently playing on DSTV. Great, fun movie, you know, four women letting you in into different aspects of their lives with all kinds of problems that they're all trying to manage and deal with. I would highly recommend that you check out the movie. Happiness is a four-letter word. I enjoyed it.
I like it. It's like a... I likened it to like the South African Sex and the City.
Well, there you see, there you go. There
and
is that.
Something so totally different for the SA film industry and really, really did well.
Yeah,
so
you know, leaning more towards the lighthearted stuff, you know, the stuff that's not so heavy and the stuff that leaves you, you know, contemplating serious things all the time. It's a nice break from what we're used to in our film industry, correct?
Yeah. So there we go. Done and dusted.
Yeah. Back tomorrow morning, 6 to 9 with myself and Ben Ramon. Will be joining us tomorrow morning because one Sia Sangwenifin is away in Cape Town. And then, hopefully we can also check in with Gareth Cliff, who is still in Austin, Texas.
Yes.
Getting involved in South by Southwest. But yes, we'll be back with you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.